Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show. This is just one segment of the show. Each weekday, Brian and his guests take on the topics of the day, and you can hear all of these conversations on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
Well, this has been another eventful week in the saga of redeveloping the World Trade Center site, and my first guest this hour should be used to it. He's had an eventful life. The news includes the defeat, for now, of the West Side Stadium by Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver for the sake of making downtown office space as competitive as possible. It includes the announcement by the NYPD in testimony before the City Council that the newly redesigned Freedom Tower will now meet security concerns. It included an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal by the widow of one of the 9/11 hijacked pilots who opposes the so-called International Freedom Center being planned for the site. She says it would be like putting a museum of tolerance over the sunken graves of the USS Arizona, unquote. And such has been the nature of the slings and arrows that Lower Manhattan Development Corporation Chairman John Whitehead has had to suffer since Governor Pataki appointed him to the job way back such a short time after the attacks in November of 2001. In his 83 years on Earth, John Whitehead has seen and led his share of action. He was there at Normandy on D-Day. He led Goldman Sachs into the global banking era. He was Undersecretary of State in the Reagan administration, was there when Reagan decided to bomb Libya. He testified in the Iran-Contra hearings. But of all those things, John Whitehead writes in a new memoir, his work to redevelop Lower Manhattan, quote, has been by far the most challenging work I have ever done. We'll talk to John Whitehead now, mostly about Lower Manhattan, but also about other things from his life and times, as documented in his new book, A Life in Leadership, From D-Day to Ground Zero, published by Basic Books. Mr. Whitehead, thanks for coming on, and thank you for your many years of service to our country.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Let me just ask you to slide up a little closer to the microphone so our listeners can hear you well. And let me begin with today's news. The NYPD has reportedly approved the redesign of the Freedom Tower, which they forced back to the drawing board for security reasons. Can you confirm that?
Yes, that's true. They have approved it.
And how different will the new version of the Freedom Tower be?
Well, it'll be a little different, but not too much different. And it's been relatively simple to make the changes. The building will be moved some number of feet further to the east, away from West Street, where the danger they felt came from an explosion of a bomb on a truck that would be coming down West Street.
And that was their main thing, to get it further set back from the street.
Yes. Right? And then we have reinforced the walls from about 1 foot of cement to about 3 feet of cement in the lower floors. We have changed somewhat the window panes, the glass in the windows on the western side of the building.
How much office space did you have to lose to
shrink
the footprint? Well,
very little office space was lost. I believe we will be likely to add one more floor of office space at the top of the building. And the configuration of the building, which is sort of a rectangle now, will become a little stubbier rectangle with slightly wider floors and a little shorter floors.
So it's still 1,776 feet.
Yes, absolutely.
In height. Absolutely. Still has a spire at the top.
Yes, it does.
And you and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly had quite a little back and forth over this issue, I understand. When the need for a redesign was announced in April, you criticized Kelly for waiting so long to bring up his security concerns. But then he released letters to the press raising exactly these concerns from his counterterrorism chief, Michael Sheehan, very specifically about setting back from the street in the summer of last year and more generally in the fall of 2003. And they say these letters were ignored. So what do you say now really happened?
Well, I think the communications wasn't very bad. I didn't mean to criticize Commissioner Kelly, although it did come out that way. He's a great police chief, and we have worked with him so well over the years on this project that I don't want to really criticize him. However, I did not know of the objection of the police department, whether that was poor communications within the LMDC or poor communications in some other way, I don't know.
But how did Kelly not have a seat at the table originally?
Well, I think he probably, if he wanted to have a seat, he could have had a seat, and he should have had a seat, because we shouldn't build a building like this without consultation with the police department, and I think there has been consultation. But I don't want to
dwell on that.
Encourage an argument between Ray Kelly and me. I would be outgunned.
That sounds like you're also just taking your lumps on that right now. You know, the Freedom Tower has its detractors like Donald Trump, who say it's ugly and pretentious and we should rebuild the Twin Towers plus one floor to show the terrorists we've won. And he keeps going around the media saying that. Was that idea ever considered by the LMDC?
Yes, it was, but several years ago, I don't know where Don was in the time that it was being considered. But I think plans have advanced well beyond that, and we're proceeding with a different set of plans.
What was the reason for not doing that?
That we didn't find that the Twin Towers were the most modern or efficient kind of buildings that should be built. They were really too large to be efficient business buildings or attractive to business. So we have a larger number of smaller buildings planned for the site.
Also because after the attacks, you couldn't be confident that you could find tenants to rent that high?
Yes, I think that's true.
And also this week, as you know, and as I think you heard us talking about before the news, Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver vetoed the mayor's West Side Stadium plan, mostly because Silver was afraid the 24 million square feet of office space planned for Midtown West would destroy Lower Manhattan as the financial capital of the world and move that distinction to Midtown. Do you agree with his analysis?
Well, I don't know that I agree with his analysis, but he and I have basically the same objectives. He is responsible for the District of Lower Manhattan, and I am responsible for the District of Lower Manhattan. And so, generally speaking, we see alike. It didn't seem appropriate for me to publicly oppose the West Side development. The mayor had his own judgment on that. But my object is to increase the interest of companies to move their offices downtown.
And so do you agree that building 24 million square feet of office space in Midtown would be, you know, obstructively competitive with that?
Yes, I'm afraid I do believe that that would be the case.
You were co-managing partner of Goldman Sachs.
Yes, I was.
Your book describes designing it as the first truly international investment banking firm, and we'll come back to that later in the interview. You left there 20 years ago. But now Goldman Sachs is considered perhaps the key to whether downtown will remain the financial center, since they're wavering on the big office building that they promised to move in there. You addressed their security concerns by agreeing to cancel a tunnel that was planned for near their building. What can you tell us about the current status of the Goldman Sachs negotiations?
Well, the Goldman Sachs announced that they were going to consider other locations in Manhattan for their building, and they are in the process of doing that. I have no inside knowledge on their plans. I have no important connection to Goldman Sachs anymore, nor will I be part of the decision. If I were part of the decision, I would urge them to move back downtown, and I hope that they do.
But you're involved in those negotiations, I presume.
I have been involved, yes.
Is this fear? Is this employees just not wanting to return near Ground Zero? Is it hardball negotiating to get more perks at taxpayers' expense? What's their reluctance?
I don't really know the reasons for their reluctance. I think the major reason was resolved when the governor decided that we would not build a tunnel. That was the thing that they were concerned about, because the tunnel would have had its entrance and exit right in front of their building in their front yard, and they felt, I think, with reason, that that would interfere with the significance and the appearance and the practicality of their building. But that's not a problem now. I think surely the security concerns that were raised but have now been resolved for the Freedom Tower might have alarmed them, but I believe that has now been resolved as well. And I'm very hopeful that they will determine that there is no site elsewhere that would be as good for them as the site in Lower Manhattan.
Do you think the symbolism of Goldman Sachs saying no, if they do say no, is so powerful that it will eventually lead to Wall Street not being the financial center of Manhattan or the world anymore, no matter what happens with the West Side?
I think that Wall Street will always be considered the center of the financial world. As long as the New York Stock Exchange is there, the Federal Reserve Bank is there, and there are many other companies that are there. But that is not to say that the Goldman Sachs decision is not a very, very important one. And we're doing everything we possibly can to make it attractive for them to develop that site.
Can you really get tenants for all that office space?
Well, I think so. It's been difficult, though. And while the residential part of redeveloping Lower Manhattan is going wonderfully well, there's a real estate boom for residents in Lower Manhattan, the office space has been very slow in recovering.
There's no anchor tenant yet for 7 World Trade.
There seems not to be. No, that's true.
So why not let the market, you're a market guy.
I am a market guy.
Why not let the market go where it goes and not have the government work so hard to try to force this to continue to be the center of the business district?
I think the market will bring people back to Lower Manhattan. I think there was a legitimate alarm when the 9/11 incident took place. It was an unpleasant part of the city for people to be located, and a lot of people moved out that way. But it's now returned to normalcy pretty much, not entirely, but still pretty much, and I think firms are beginning to reconsider. The major thing that's happened in the last few weeks is the decision by Morgan Stanley, a leading one of the top investment banking firms in the country, in the world, has led to their renting a very considerable amount of, yes, of unoccupied space in Lower Manhattan.
200,000 square feet.
Well, more than that. I think the number has not yet been finally announced, but there have been several steps in there, and maybe they haven't stopped yet. They're planning on more and more people coming back downtown.
And
I believe that will be an important symbol to others.
And what about the Port Authority as a symbol? Some people have been very critical of the Port Authority, which of course owns the land, for not moving its offices and its employees back there.
Well, I think it's all a matter of money, and I think there are hopes that the Port Authority will move its offices. They had their major offices in the old World Trade Center building, and I think it would be an ideal place for them to move their offices, and I believe if the rent is attractive to them, they will do so.
Wait, they own it? Well, Silverstein has leased it. So he would get to rent it back to the owners?
That's certainly the way it was before when the Port Authority rented space in the two Twin Towers when Silverstein signed his lease.
But they still have a stake in it as the owners, so shouldn't they be leading the way?
Well, I hope they do. I hope they see it that way. The governor of New York and New Jersey are in charge of the Port Authority, and they would have some influence on the Port Authority's decisions.
Okay.
But they also have to be conscious of the cost of the move and the rent that they would pay.
LMDC has been criticized for not having any Asian Americans on its board when Chinatown is so much a central part of what you're trying to redevelop. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that it's a legitimate criticism. When we were formed, we did have a Chinese woman on the board who was a very talented member of the board, Billy Chin, an architect, and she was an ideal member of the board because of her architectural background and skills. But she decided that it was too much of a burden to run her own architectural firm and be on the board, and so she resigned. And her space has not been filled yet, and I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in the months ahead the governor or the mayor, who both have vacancies to fill, might pick a representative from Chinatown.
93.9 AM 820 WNYC. Will continue with the head of the LMDC, John Whitehead, in just a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with John Whitehead, the chairman of the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation. He was appointed just 2 months after the September 11th attacks to lead the LMDC into rebuilding Ground Zero. And he has written a book now called A Life in Leadership, From D-Day to Ground Zero. And we can take phone calls for John Whitehead at 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. Are you a New Yorker by birth?
No, I was born in Illinois, but at the age of two, my family moved to New Jersey, and I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey, went to public schools there and to high school there.
So
I'm really a native of New Jersey, and I lived there until about 15 years ago, commuting from New Jersey to Goldman Sachs, and then...
You lived in Essex Fells, didn't you?
I lived in Essex Fells, yes.
So you grew up in Jersey, too. That I didn't know. Every year around this time, our thoughts turn at least briefly to D-Day, and you were there at Normandy, Dog Red Beach, as you describe in the book. What was your role in the assault?
Well, I was on an amphibious transport, which is the large boats that carry a lot of little boats on their deck and carry troops. And the little boats are lowered into the water, and they're called LCVPs, Landing Craft Vehicle and Personnel. And the soldiers get into them, and then we drive them into the beach. And I was a young ensign, 22 years old at the time. And I was responsible for a small wave of those little boats, five of them. And we landed in the first wave at Normandy on Dog Red Beach in the Omaha sector. I will not forget it.
The famous Omaha Beach. You saw a lot of people killed.
Yes, we did.
How do you think that experience colored your approach to the rest of your life?
Well, it was a leadership experience that one doesn't usually have, but a life-or-death kind of experience that early in life. And coming into the beach, we had this experience that is described in the book, where a line of what were called element seas in the water that were designed to block a landing and to have small boats unable to get through this block of blockade along the beach. And I had to make one of those quick decisions in about 5 seconds, whether to follow my orders and go straight into the beach or, as we decided to do, turn left and look for an opening through these beach defenses. And we did that, and we got into the beach successfully.
You spent part of your career under President Reagan working for freedom in Eastern Europe under Secretary of State George Shultz.
Yes.
One line that fascinated me from your book was that on a tour of Eastern Europe in the mid-'80s, you concluded that Soviet communism was economically unviable and would collapse under its own weight sooner rather than later,
yes,
as, of course, it did in 1989. How come no one was predicting that publicly at the time? Why did it seem to take everybody by surprise?
Well, I think if you were involved in it every day, as I was in my visits to Eastern Europe, you saw how the people of those countries, which the Soviet Union were counting on to be its allies in any kind of military action that might take place, the people in those countries were not at all loyal to the Soviet Union, and off the record were willing to talk to me about being weaned away from their complete dependence on the Soviet Union. And even the puppet governments of those countries that had been appointed by the communists in Moscow were willing to talk to me about their long-range hopes that they were Western European countries and not Eastern European countries, and that they belonged with us and not against us. And so I was able to take some little steps that broke some of those ties, and I could tell that those people were just eager to break away from the Soviet Union as soon as it was possible.
And so, you know, liberals and conservatives will forever debate whether the Reagan military buildup in the 80s forced the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, Soviet Empire, or whether it would have collapsed under its own weight anyway, and all that spending and all that debt for America was unnecessary. What do you think?
Well, I don't claim credit for the Reagan administration change, but I think we gave it a few nudges in the right direction. I give the principal amount of credit to Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev realized the system wasn't working, and that was a sensible conclusion. His phrases of of freedom and change were the order of the day. And he basically threw in the towel on the Cold War. He didn't really know how to go about developing a free market system, and so there was a certain amount of chaos for some years in Russia particularly. But the Eastern European countries were freed to go back to the freer life that they had led before the Russian occupation.
So are you saying that even without the Reagan military buildup, Gorbachev probably would have found himself in the same spot?
No, I think the military buildup was necessary to help persuade Gorbachev that he couldn't win this war.
My guest on WNYC is John Whitehead, Lower Manhattan Development Corporation chairman. His new book is A Life and Leadership. And we'll take phone calls in just a minute at 212-267-WNYC. But talk a little bit about your Goldman Sachs days. What do you mean when you say in the book that you helped it become the first truly international banking firm?
Well, when I was coming up in Goldman Sachs, we only were working in the United States. We were a U.S.-based investment banking firm. But I began to see that our customers, our clients, particularly the corporate clients, were operating all over the world. And if we couldn't supply investment banking services to them in Europe and in Asia when they had operations there, couldn't raise money for them in those countries, we would be losing out to other firms that were more foresighted. So I... We were the last of the major firms to come to other countries. The other major firms had already preceded us, but we had a crash program to move internationally, which was difficult with some of my partners who were happy the way it was. We were very successful within the United States, but we had to spread our wings internationally. And now we are as important in other parts of the world as we are here in the United States.
I don't know if you've seen the lead story in the New York Times today. It's about the U.S. and U.K. agreeing to debt relief for 18 poor countries, mostly in Africa, letting them off the hook for $17 billion that they owe to international lenders.
Yes.
Is it companies like Goldman Sachs that will have to eat that $17 billion?
Well, it's our customers who bought those securities from us a number of years ago. And many of the debts were owed to banks rather than not many to individuals. These were debts that have been written off long ago by the institutions that own them. Because there was no way that these countries were going to be able to repay them. These are the poorest of the poor countries, which just have no chance of repaying the debt, and it seemed sensible to let them write it off their books because they're just too poor to ever have any expectation that they could be repaid.
So was it bad judgment on somebody's part to lend them that money?
Well, the countries were better credits when the loans were made than they have proved to be now.
There are also critics of the current global banking system who say these U.S.-based lenders, along with the IMF and World Bank, prey on poor countries by enticing them into loans they can't afford for development projects they don't need to keep money flowing to U.S.-based contractors who then get hired to go down there and do the work. How much of that do you agree with?
Well, I don't agree with any of that. No, I just don't think that's true at all. These are countries that could not be easily enticed into borrowing money that they couldn't afford to pay back. So the countries only borrow money when they want to, not when they're told by somebody else to do so.
Put on your headphones. We're going to take a few phone calls from listeners. John Whitehead, LMDC, Lower Manhattan Development Corporation chairman, my guest. His new book, A Life and Leadership, From D-Day to Ground Zero, 212-267-WNYC, 267-9692. Sean in Bronxville, you're on WNYC. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Good morning. I would like to know if your guest had any say in the monument that was proposed to be built for the emergency service workers, and was he for it or against it? And I also would like to know, since the Trade Center had such a hard problem with vacancies pre-September 11th. What makes them think that now they're going to be able to refill the vacancies that they had or the office space? And why not concentrate more on housing, some affordable housing? And since the real estate market is so hot, why aren't they focusing more on trying to build some more housing down there so they can bring people and energy back to that area by having people live there 24/7.
Well, let me take the your first question. I don't know anything about that project of a memorial to the workers who, but those workers were wonderful people, and they worked long hours and did a great job. And if there's any way that we can thank them with a memorial, I would be all for it.
Sean,
It wasn't the workers. Let me preface it, be a full disclosure. I am a firefighter. There was a movement to have a separate monument for the firefighters and police and EMS workers that died on September 11th. And for some reason, the people who designed the new tower and the new area were against having a separate. They felt that it would decrease the importance of the civilians who died, which I don't agree. I just think that they were separate. It's kind of like dying in battle, being a war victim.
You know about that.
Yes, I do know. I misunderstood the question, but you're right that there has been a controversy between the firemen and the policemen who lost their lives saving the lives of as many people as they could, and the people who were office workers had lost their lives. But the feeling was on the part of the relatives of the deceased families, which was in the large majority of the victims were, but certainly not all of the victims were in the a building, but not the people who saved lives. They felt that one soul is no more important than another soul.
And that was the decision that was made.
And that was the decision that was made, that everybody would be treated equally.
Sean, thank you for your call. And what about his other point that if there's such demand for housing and lack of demand for office space, I guess it's the same question I asked before. Why not let the market go where it seems to be going and develop it more for housing than for office?
We don't need to have government subsidies for housing anymore because the demand for housing is so great that office buildings are being converted to housing and new buildings for housing are being built at a very rapid rate. When all the buildings that are the housing that is now on the now being planned is completed, there will be twice as many people living in Lower Manhattan as there were on 9/11.
And will it take government subsidies to get companies to return there?
Well, I think it will. That is our problem, getting companies to return. And so we are placing we need jobs.
Why is that worth my tax dollars?
We need jobs downtown to make that a part of the community. We can't allow it to become just a residential community with no jobs for the people that live there. So we need to have office space down there. All of this planning, a building takes 4 or 5 years to complete from the origination of the idea to the occupancy of the building. And so we have to think ahead as to what the situation is going to be. And we need the situation to create more jobs down there.
Jack in Oceanside, you're on WNYC with John Whitehead.
Hello?
Hello, Jack.
How are you doing? What I wanted to say, a couple of things. We've been involved in investing in New York City. Old company, probably started about 75 years ago. We pulled out of New York City, but we've basically because of the rent control laws really screwed us up in the 70s. The problem with investing right now, and I've discussed it with other people, is number one, who's going to want to go and have a office in a building that basically is a high-rise building, hard to get out of, and would be seen as a potential target.
All right. That question comes up a lot.
Well, there are people that that feel that those buildings are perfectly safe. None of us know where or when or whether terrorists are going to strike again. And many of us feel that they're no more likely to strike in Lower Manhattan again than they could strike almost anywhere else in the world. So most people are willing, are not reluctant to live to work or live in a high-rise building.
Thank you for your call, Jack. Another downtown issue. There's a backlash developing against the International Freedom Center that would be part of the memorial and cultural complex. You probably saw the op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal this week by Deborah Burlingame, widow of one of the 9/11 pilots. And she says a 9/11 memorial should be about 9/11 only and not about a broad reflective history of freedom and slavery. And she writes, quote, "It would be like putting a museum of tolerance over the sunken graves of the USS Arizona," unquote. Have you seen the piece?
I've seen the piece, and I don't believe there was any reason for her fears. The content of that building will not be a right-wing museum talking about freedom in America as being best for everybody. It will not be that. It will not be a left-wing museum either, talking about soft issues. It will be an unpolitical museum that will not show politics one way or another.
This is developing as a right-wing cause celeb now to try to stop that because they're afraid of highlighting Jim Crow and slaughter of the Indians and anti-American stuff.
People need have no fear of that. We're not going to let it develop like that.
It wouldn't discuss those issues from a balanced point of view?
Well, we're still, of course, planning the content of that museum, which won't be ready for occupancy for several more years, and there will be a lot of thought given, but we will keep politics, political points of view out of it. It's largely a historical museum that will talk about the facts of history in America and elsewhere around the world. It's going to be an international museum that will have other countries' views of freedom. South Africa is a country that has said that they would like to have the first international exhibit of what freedom has meant to them.
And the Freedom Center is the baby of Roland Betts, who's on your board, and Tom Bernstein, who are both very close personally to President Bush. Do you know that he, the president, personally endorses the idea?
I don't believe the president has considered the contents of that museum building himself, but I do know that Roland Betts is a Democrat, and so he's not of the same party as his close friend President Bush. And so I don't believe there's any legitimate fear that this is going to be a Republican right-wing kind of museum.
Last thing. You're a loyal, lifelong Republican, but at the end of your book, you seem to question the Bush administration's approach to the rest of the world. You write, "The last several years have had their unhappy moments for those of us who believe that diplomacy, given time and patience, can almost always prevail." You go on. You worry eventually citizens of other countries will dislike America more, dislike American products more. How unhappy are you with the direction of the Bush administration, including the Iraq War? And we have 30 seconds.
Well, I'll just say it quickly. I am unhappy with both some of the foreign policy of President Bush and some of the domestic policy of President Bush. I am not a right-winger. I am a moderate Republican. And I believe that that wing of the party has sort of moved away from we moderates, who also feel that we're good Republicans and that it's our party, too.
His party, too. John C. Whitehead, chairman of the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, now the author of a memoir called A Life in Leadership, From D-Day to Ground Zero. It's published by the New America Books imprint of Basic Books. Good luck. We're all counting on you to succeed at Ground Zero. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. Been a pleasure being with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Our Andrea Bernstein is going to stop by in just a minute and give us an update on the U.S. Olympic bid. What after the West Side Stadium defeat?
Thanks for checking out today's podcast of The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.